In this episode of the Atypical Behavior Analyst, we travel inward to evaluate the value of both internal and external self-awareness, as it is important to take note of our orbital path and the impact that ours has on others. Within our discussion of self-awareness, we provide behavior analytic translations, as well as practical examples of how to incorporate it into our personal and professional practices. So with that said, let's begin the journey inward. Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. I'm Shanna, and I am here with Kelly.
Hello.
And this is our episode on self-awareness. Before we begin, though, we want to go over a few things with you. First of all, for those who don't already know, we are ACE approved, which means that you can earn a CE for listening. So during the talk, we're going to provide two keywords and that you can take over to our website at www.atypicalba.com. You'll fill out a form, enter those two keywords, submit that to us, and then you will have a CE delivered to your email inbox in just a few days. Also, we are on Facebook and would love to hear from you. You can find us there at the Atypical Behavior Analyst. So now that we've covered those things, let's go ahead and get started with our discussion on self-awareness. All right, so we are going to begin by talking about the purpose for our talk today on self-awareness. We, you know, digging around and reading and looking more into self-awareness, we realized, hey, there may be a lot of benefit to being a little more self-aware. So let's kind of see what this is all about. And as we did that, we've realized how there's so many different important things that we can gain in life in general, but since we are here focused on the behavior analytic world, it definitely can help us in many ways as behavior analyst, and also help those people that we are working with, whether those are our coworkers or also the clients and stakeholders. So there's just so many benefits to all involved to be more self-aware. So we just thought this was a really important episode to bring to you. And so with that, I would just like to cover with you or share with you what we're going to be talking about today. We will be discussing what is self-awareness, explaining that, those definitions of it, and then we're going to talk about why what we do matters. With self-awareness, there are many definitions out there. For the most part, some of them are pretty similar, but I'm going to just, for the sake of time, cover two of those with you. One of those comes from an article that I read by Emily Kaiser, and the article is titled, What is Self-Awareness and Why is it Important? In her article, she talks about the, or she references the Collaboration for Academic and Social Emotional Learning, and they defined self-awareness as the ability to accurately recognize one's own emotions, thoughts, and values, and how they influence behavior. The ability to accurately assess one's strengths and limitations with a well-grounded sense of confidence, optimism, and a growth mindset. She goes on to explain what self-awareness is, you know, by recognizing our emotions, identifying triggers, and empathizing with others. Then in another article by Tasha Urich is what self-awareness really is and how to cultivate it. In her article, she refers to two types of self-awareness, both being very important, and those being internal and external self-awareness. With internal self-awareness, it refers to how clearly we see our values, passions, the fit with our environment, reactions, including thoughts, feelings, behaviors, strengths, and weaknesses, and impact on others. With the external self-awareness, it's understanding how others view us.
So Shanna has given two really cool outside of the field of behavior analysis ideas and descriptions of what self-awareness could potentially be defined as. So I decided that, cool, what does our field say about it? What do we as behavior analysts, when we talk about self-awareness, because like, you know, it is, it's starting to be more discussed. And it's really cool to see the change and the shift in ideas and some research on this. So I actually started with an article called, let me double check. Yeah, The Behavioral and the Mystical, Reflections on Behaviorism and Eastern Thought by John Williams from 1986 in The Behavior Analyst. And he makes the comment of he wishes to show that there's these interesting parallels that are part of a larger picture of science and the role that it plays in how we view and deal with worldly phenomenon. And in my head, sounds like self-awareness. You got to find your place in the universe. He goes on to quote Watts from 1961, from physics to psychology, every department of science is realizing more and more that to observe the world is to participate in it. And that, frustrating as it may be, may seem to be, it is the most important clue to all further knowledge. So my head started to explode a little bit and I was like, yeah, this totally sounds like self-awareness. Again, figuring out how your actions influence somebody else or impact somebody else. You know, we see contingencies all the time and, you know, we see their SDs and we see how the behavior is evoked by that, or if it's an S delta, how it, you know, isn't. Another thing that he mentions is, still going with this behavioral and the mystical, is the implications of behaviorism are that behavioral events compose of such an extended system, how all the events are intertwined. So that is, behavioral events are part of a space-time flow that has no beginning or ending through time and across space at any instant. Again, brain's kind of exploding and I was like, oh, this is so cool. It's the behavioral butterfly effect. If something happens, you know, how far out do the ripples go? And I then had to bring myself back down off of my, you know, this heady theoretical, you know, tangent space and go, okay, that's a little too much for, you know, an initial podcast. So let's bring it down a little bit. And I came across an article by Travis Thompson entitled Self-Awareness, Behavior Analysis, and Neuroscience, 2008, also in The Behavior Analyst. And he defines self-awareness as specific type of autoclitic discriminative behavior and inferential generalization to similar performances exhibited by other people. Cool. I can totally understand that one as well. But again, I still feel like it's a little bit heady right now. Not gonna lie, I've not had quite enough coffee to delve into verbal behavior side, but it's something that we can totally come back to. And then I had another couple of definitions. One is from Diamond and Barnes, and it states that self-awareness is produced in a large part by social contingencies that reinforce discrimination of the organism's own behavior. And then another article by Ashley was an inwardly focused evaluative process in which individuals make self-standard comparisons with the goal of better self-knowledge and improvement. And I feel like that last one really hits it on the head with what Shanna was discussing in her first two definitions from Emily Kaiser and Tasha Urich. And so I started thinking about that and I was like, okay, so we do a lot of self-monitoring. And so self-awareness is becoming something that behavior analysts are looking more into, or we're coming back to researching again, because, you know, the first article with Williams is from 1986. And so it's fun to go back and see that, okay, let's revisit some ideas and see if we can get some new research. So on that, I went down a Google Scholar, I believe, dive, and I came across an article entitled Self-Monitoring in Clinical Practice, a Challenge for Medical Educators. And it is from 2008 by Epstein, Siegel, and Silberman. And it's not behavior analytic. It comes from the Foundations of Continuing Education, and it's, you know, medical education. But they talk about self-assessment and self-monitoring in ways that we do as well. And so the way that they described self-assessment, or they defined it, was it can be summative. So it's engaging in periodic formal self-assessments. It's predictive. You're anticipating future needs, which we can get into some cool stuff with that. And then it's concurrent. And so you get self-monitoring on everyday tasks. And I think this is where we can really hone in on and be helpful with giving more information about self-monitoring in this concept of self-awareness. They further go on to say that self-monitoring is characterized by an ability to attend to moment-to-moment to our own actions. So can you observe your behavior? Okay. Curiosity to examine the effects of those actions. What are the consequences of my actions? And the willingness to use those observations to improve behavior and patterns of thinking in the future. And this goes back to feedback loops that we've discussed previously. It's really cool to be able to see how all these various areas of fields and professions and ways of thinking, we all say the same thing. And we, I think, as behavior analysts, have this super cool opportunity to be able to scientifically describe things. But we also need to be aware, too, that we're using terminology that other people are going to be willing to accept. Because like I mentioned with the first couple definitions, they're a little heady. It's you know, not everyone wants to sit with the caterpillar and discuss behavior philosophy. With that being said, let's move on to why is it important to talk about self-awareness, and what are some of the benefits to being self-aware? And it's not just all benefits. There's several issues that may come up. It's not comfortable to analyze yourself. You know, living in pandemic times when there's not a whole lot of opportunities to go out, it was, I think, a long year of self-reflection for a lot of people because you're left alone with your thoughts, and that can be uncomfortable. So Shanna, do you want to jump in? Because I know you've got some really cool things about that uncomfortableness.
Again, referencing that the article by Tasha Urich, you know, there is one part in there where she talks about experience and power and can hinder self-awareness. It's just talking about as we grow in our leadership positions, as we get, you know, higher up in the leadership chain, that kind of thing, how we may have less opportunities for self-awareness. And so, you know, I was thinking of that and what is that relationship to us in the work that we do. And that could be that we are an owner of a business that provides behavior analytic treatment. We could be a BCBA who's overseeing a team of individuals, RBTs, BCABAs, you know, whoever it may be. Or perhaps we are a behavior analyst who is, I'm going to say just, I don't want to make it sound as if that's an easy job, but a behavior analyst who's just working directly with clients and their stakeholders. And even that, there's still a leadership position in doing that. You know, we're trying to guide the client and the stakeholders who are trying to help the client. We're trying to guide them to ways of improving their life and increasing their skill sets and things like that. So that's what, those are those things that I'm talking about when I'm talking about leaders and what I'm about to say regarding that. It just talks about as we increase in those leadership positions, we might have less opportunities to receive feedback on ourselves and the things that we're doing well with. And definitely it's harder, you know, in a leadership position for others to tell us maybe what we're not doing so well with or what we could benefit from changing and growing with. And two, her article talks about how in higher level leadership positions, we more significantly overvalue our skills, especially compared with others, you know, perceptions of us. And she talks about like two possible explanations for this. You know, we may have fewer people above us who can provide that candid feedback. And then also that the more power a leader has, the less comfortable people will be with giving that constructive feedback for fear that it'll hurt their careers. And so those are definitely things that, you know, most all of us can relate to. There's a quote that she has in there from business professor James O'Toole, who says, as one's power grows, one's willingness to listen shrinks, either because they think they know more than their employees or because seeking feedback will come at a cost. So, you know, all of this to say is that just because we're in a leadership position, we still can benefit from self-awareness. And I mean, maybe in some ways more than people who aren't in a leadership position, because we're not only impacting ourselves, we're leading other people. We are directing other people, and we need to make sure that we're doing that well.
So one of the things that I think is really cool with what you're talking about with this concept with self-awareness and looking at the systems of it, it's not just how I and my, you know, my client, but it's also the stakeholders. So the caregiver. So it could be a parent, it could be a teacher, it could be a dayhab staff, it could be a vocational, a job. And so there's multiple areas that this application is useful in. So, you know, teaching a client, or if you're in a supervisor position and you're supervising someone who's going to become a BCBA or is going to sit for the exam, this is a perfect opportunity to include those skills and show what, you know, model self-awareness. And then you can teach those skills to them as well. And then you see how it kind of flows down again, that behavioral butterfly effect. And so some of the other benefits that we see is that when you're teaching, the more that you become, you know, self-aware, while it is a little bit uncomfortable, your communication skills improve, which in turn makes your rapport better. And you have better relationships with your supervisee or your mentee, the teacher that you're working with, the parents that you're working with, the client, you know, whether it's a child or an adult or an adolescent, it improves that relationship, which can then improve treatment fidelity, and progress can be made. And you may see a decrease in challenging behaviors and an increase in skill acquisition, or just maintenance of good and calm. And that's really cool, because that's what we want. We want to, you know, improve people's lives and be able to teach people to think, you know, not be behavior analysts, but to just think critically when certain incidents occur. So Shannon, do you have any other thoughts on either benefits or other potential barriers that people may come across when they're trying to become more self-aware?
Yeah. Thinking on that, you know, you had mentioned like some of the literature that's more in the behavior analytics side of things regarding self-awareness, and then to just, you know, barriers and benefits, like you said. And this is an article I have referenced many times. And I think, you know, Kelly as well, but there's just so much good, valuable information in this article. It's compassionate care and behavior analytic treatment. Can outcomes be enhanced by attending to relationship with caregivers? And in that article, you know, they talk about compassion and empathy, you know, putting ourselves in other shoes, you know, that perspective taking, all that kind of stuff. And in doing so, it's like, okay, well, how do I become more, you know, compassionate and have more empathy, those kind of things. And the article later on into it, it actually uses the word, you know, the term self-awareness in there. And it talks about how we as behavior analysts need to become more self-aware, and how if we aren't practicing self-awareness in the work that we do, then it can really hinder how well we're working with others. You know, that is being able to, one thing I think of is more of like what Tasha Urich talks about, is that external self-awareness. Do we have a good idea of how others are perceiving us and how they view us? And, you know, we need to be able, when we're sharing and talking and interacting with the clients and the stakeholders, you know, those people you mentioned, whether that's parents, caregivers, staff members at a group home, whatever it may be, that, you know, we need to be, you know, looking into that body language and the things that they say, and all of those types of things, and trying to understand, are they understanding what I'm saying? Are they on board with what I'm saying? Those kind of things. Because if we're just plowing through thinking that we're providing this awesome information and this great treatment plan, and we have all the right answers, but they're feeling a little differently, we need to cue into that, and we need to address that. And that is going to come with self-awareness. And so, you know, just as you're talking and where our conversation has kind of led, Kelly, it made me think of that article. One is just to provide one more article that's in the world of behavior analysis that addresses self-awareness, but then also just some applications and just some ideas and examples of how we can apply the practice of self-awareness in the work that we do.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was thinking a little bit more about those applications in the areas. And so it's not just self-awareness and making sure that the staff that I'm training or the individuals that I'm training are understanding, but also that I'm understanding and perceiving accurately things that they're telling me. Like you mentioned, body language and being attuned to that. When you go into a session or you go into a home, what's the response? Do people flock to you, or do they, you know, kind of roll their eyes that you're there, like, oh man, the behavior person's here again? Are you perceiving that? And then are you following up with that to see if your perception is accurate? And so we'll get more into kind of the nitty gritty on how to, and some ideas on practicing self-awareness. But some of the other benefits that I wanted to mention before we get too far in. So it's not just, sorry, I'm jumping around a little bit and I apologize. So we work with the staff. And then there's also being self-aware when you're working with the individual, your learner, you know, not just on their programs on skill acquisition, but if they have challenging behavior, or they have, maybe they're working on tolerance skills and sitting at a table for longer periods, or having more people around them. That's one of the challenges you can see in like a day hab or a group home, is someone who's not used to a lot of external stimuli can get very overwhelmed very quickly in a day hab, and which can lead to problem behavior. And so self-awareness is valuable in catching that and being able to understand the whole context of that behavior and not just that it's an escape behavior, but that there's more to it. And when you have that kind of analysis, so you can implement those kind of programs, and then you can teach the staff or the caregivers that self-awareness so that they too can continue to work with this individual in ways that are less reactive and more responsive. They're shaping. There's more probability that someone's going to be looking for good behaviors when they're being self-aware. They're going to be more preventative. The self-monitoring clinical practice article mentioned that's one component of self-assessment is being looking at the future, you know, thinking two or three steps ahead of, okay, if this happens, then what else goes on? And so that improves your treatment. It improves the person that you're working with and it helps improve their life because now everyone is on the same page and like I said, responding instead of being emotional and reacting. Some of the other cool benefits that I came across when I was reading these different articles included things like decreasing bias and judgment and blame. So in the clinical article, they were talking about practitioners working with patients who maybe had amputations or were in there for diabetes. And the comment that they made was so often they would just look at the diagnosis and they stopped there with their thinking. There wasn't anything further. And so they were snap judgments and it was very solution focused treatments. And one of the examples they gave was that, you know, an individual was in for some urinary issues. And so they drained some of it, but then it wasn't marked correctly. And then but they went in. And so when they saw the unknowingly incorrect diagnosis, they added some more fluid. And then the poor individual's even more pain, only to come to find out, oh, it wasn't written down correctly, didn't interpret it correctly. We made a snap judgment. And so thankfully the individual was able to have their urine removed, drained. And so it worked out okay. But unfortunately, that's such a common thing and it doesn't always work out okay. So there's that benefit of instead of having a snap judgment that could have dire consequences, you take a second to breathe and you take a second to respond and take a look at the whole picture, which goes into increasing your flexibility and you become a little bit more creative maybe with what you're teaching and your training and how you're responding. And like Shanna mentioned, with being in a position of leadership or supervision, you know, CEO of a company down to a junior or senior coach in a clinic, it improves those management skills because you become aware of your behavior and the consequence is, how does it affect other people? You know, like with rapport, do they come to me or do I have to go seek them out when we need to talk? And then you become aware of like, oh snap, I only ever seek them out to tell them bad things or to correct them or to give them constructive criticism. I don't ever just send an email that says, hey, I think you're rad, keep up the good work. And so you start to become aware of your actions and your motivations, and that can help improve, again, those relationships with the people that you're working with, which one of the big benefits then is it decreases burnout. And in our field, in medical fields and mental health, when you're working with humans, it's tough. We're really tough. We are a hard nut to crack because we have lots of learning histories and lots of variables and lots of weird, twisted contingencies that have formed over our years. And so burnout can be a very, very real thing. But when you become self-aware, it's not that you'll never experience any kind of burnout, but you start to realize when your brain's feeling like mush, or maybe you're like, man, I'm just agitated. Like, I don't want to do anything. Like, I'm just frustrated. Every time I get on a call or I go see a client, I'm just, ugh. And you catch yourself when you're self-aware and like, oh, okay, well, maybe I need to take a time out. Maybe I just need a mental health day. You know, when was the last time I took one of those? I had a vacation. Did I work every single weekend for the last month? For sure. And so being able to capture your behaviors and your emotions helps with decreasing your emotional responding and your potential burnout. And then it flows down to the people that you work with, the people that you're helping to teach and that you're helping to train.
If you're listening for CEs, your first keyword is work, W-O-R-K. With hard work comes growth. Yeah. So kind of as you're talking, it makes me think of, you know, through what I read, this image kind of came to my mind, but I don't know if they worded it this exact way, but it's almost, you know, with self-awareness and the practice of it, you know, it's almost balancing your strengths and your weaknesses. You know, it's figuring out what they are, but then also balancing them, because you don't want to just focus on the strengths, you know, and you're a little overconfident, and then you become that, like that leader that I described, or the leaders, you know, who it actually hinders them. So it's recognizing, here are my strengths, and keeping them in their proper perspective and place, not inflating them a little bit too much more so than they should be. But then also spending time on what are my weaknesses, and working through those. And it, to me, it kind of seems like that balance of those two, to make sure that you have, I don't know, I see it as I'm gaining the confidence from the strengths that I have, but I'm also recognizing I have weaknesses, and I'm going to start working on those so that I can just continually improve. And that's going to help us to have those better work relationships with others, that, you know, and with coworkers, and also with staff and the stakeholders, like we talked about. You know, Kelly had mentioned something about like blaming. You know, I think that I know I've been guilty of this, of when things haven't worked out, it's so easy to blame the issue on, well, the caregiver didn't do this. If they would have done like I said, you know, this would be better, or client would just do this. You know, we can easily do that. And there may be the time and place where it's like, you know, we do need involvement, obviously, to be able to make the progress. When our minds start heading in that direction of that blame, I think it's that, you know, again, that practice of self-awareness, where we step back and say, why aren't they doing that? You know, and it can be that looking at it from the standpoint of, what did I say to them? You know, how did I present it to them? What was their, again, their body language, their body posture? What did they say in response to all of this? You know, did I ask them, you know, do they think it could work? You know, is there, what kind of things could prevent them from doing that? And that, you know, doing that, you know, as opposed to just hanging on to the blame of saying, okay, let's figure out why this isn't happening, and investigating those things about myself and about that person that I'm talking to and interacting with, can help us to know what to do next to help to try to remedy the situation.
I totally agree. As we've said, there's several benefits to becoming self-aware. Again, not just for your own personal life, but it'll affect things professionally, and it will impact your relationships in across the board, really. So not just the people that you work with, but, you know, your house spouse maybe, or your kids, or your animals. But we've also said that it is uncomfortable, and it can take a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of practice. So if you're willing to get a little bit uncomfortable with us, Shanna and I, through our different readings, have found what we think are some really cool ideas on different ways to become self-aware, or to utilize self-awareness, and how to practice it on even just, you know, that self-monitoring, that day-to-day, that moment-to-moment analysis. So Shanna, I'm going to let you start, because you've got some cool stuff with Tasha.
So in her article, you know, she gets to a point where she talks about introspection. And so that may have been a word that came to your mind as we have been talking about what self-awareness is, and some examples of, you know, how we could implement that in our day-to-day work life. And, you know, she's talking about it like introspection as examining the causes of our thoughts and feelings and behaviors. And, you know, she talks about how introspection could potentially cause you to be less self-aware, and it's kind of like how some people might go about introspecting. A lot of people ask why, you know, they may be like, why do I do this? You know, why? And just kind of get stuck and ruminate on that why, you know, and focus too much on the negative, those weaknesses that we have, and just keep mulling over it and keep living in the past of what already happened, or how we presently are, you know, and the issues we have. But she talks about how, and this is through her reading through a lot of research on self-awareness, and also through some research that she and her colleagues have done, that they found out actually the common denominator in those who have that good internal and external self-awareness. The difference is that they ask more what questions. So once they realize, okay, here's the challenge I'm faced with, here's this weakness I have, here's this skill deficit, or whatever it may be that you find through that process of self-awareness, we need to take that issue and then say, okay, what now? In that research article, you know, it mentions how what questions help us stay objective, future focused, and empowered to act on our new insights. So we need to, when we are going through that process of self-awareness, this daily practice of it, you know, we come across something where we realize this is an area where I need to improve, where I need to work on. Asking those what questions is going to be helpful. You know, asking the questions of what now? What do I need to do about this in order to move forward in a better direction, in order to better help the people that I'm working with? You know, we gave some of those, you know, examples earlier. You know, whenever we're interacting, it could be, okay, maybe that what do I need to do now is paying more attention to the body language, to the words that other people are saying, paying attention to what's happening, what's not happening. But anyways, all that to say is when we're thinking of self-awareness and we're wanting to put this into practice, don't focus so much on the why. Tasha may not have said this exactly in that article, but what I took from it is I don't see necessarily there being something bad with asking why, because maybe understanding the why can help me move forward, but it's not staying in that why mode. It's going from why to then asking those what questions. What can I do now to move forward in a better direction? So that's kind of the overarching idea of what we need to do as we come across those things that we do need to work on as we're practicing self-awareness.
Yeah, so one of my thoughts off of that is a different way of maybe talking about self-awareness is considering it as a feedback loop. So if I am learning to review and analyze my own behavior in the middle of a crisis or in the middle of a game or a teaching session with an individual or a staff, you know, a caregiver, then I need to complete that loop because, like you said, that introspection is only one step. It's the first part of it. I need to actively go and seek out, hey, here's my interpretation of what happened. Is that what you perceived? And make sure that it's accurate, that your interpretation is accurate, and also that what you are putting out there is being interpreted the way that you intend it. And if it's not, being able to complete that feedback loop by, okay, so what are the action steps we need to do now? The what now portion of it. And that changes your behavior. And then in the next moment or the next incident, you go back through yourself, your checks and, okay, so this was a little bit different and here's how I responded. And, oh, the outcome was different this time. You know, so you're closing that feedback loop, essentially. You're not just sitting, like you said, in your head in this, well, why did I do that? It's more of, okay, I did it because of these reasons. It may or may not have worked out. Here are the variables that I was focusing on. Here's what I need to change next time. And then if other people are there, you know, running it by them to make sure that you, like I said, are perceiving things accurately. And so I think it's kind of cool that we can consider it that way. And another way that I was looking and that I came across while reading about this was that self-monitoring is self-awareness. So that moment-to-moment analysis of what are the SDs for your behavior? You know, not just the SDs for the individual's behavior. You know, we tend to look at that a lot. But when I watch behavior analysts that I consider natural and they are fluent in the science and they can shape behavior beautifully and skill acquisition just looks flawless when they're teaching another individual or their learner. But if a crisis happens, they're calm, they're collected, everything could be on fire and they're just this beacon of hope in the midst of it. And when I've talked with them afterwards, a lot of what they'll say is that they are looking for certain features in the environment and then within the client. And they're thinking about all of the contingencies very quickly. I mean, it's something that they practiced over time. No one comes in being a master at something. You know, it takes practice and it takes energy. And so over time, they have learned when I see certain things in the environment, you know, with this individual, when more than two people come into a room, they may get agitated. And so I saw it in my peripheral that there were some people standing by the door. And so I went ahead and, you know, hey, maybe let's go take a walk. And I intervened beforehand. It's that predictive Epstein et al. Was talking about with self-assessment. And I just think that's so cool because as you practice this self-awareness or self-monitoring and you're tracking your behaviors and your emotional responses, it progresses forward into being able to see what your learner is going through, and then predicting maybe with a little bit more delicacy and like Shanna mentioned, compassion and empathy, what their behavior may do. And then what the consequences may be when they do engage in that behavior and what your response needs to be in regards to that. So you start seeing the ABC diagram is not just this three-term contingency, but to go back to the mysticism in Williams, this flowing stream of behavior where one little variable that happened maybe early on in the day, the ripples are still affecting. And so when you have that broader sense of your place, that self-awareness of where you are, and you start to expand and get a little bit uncomfortable and see how you can impact other people, you can make really cool changes happen.
Yeah. You know, when you mention feedback and, you know, we talked about that feedback loop in a previous episode and you've talked about it again today. You know, that is one of those things when I talked about leaders and how the higher up you are as a leader, how it can impact it. You know, one of the things, especially as far as that external self-awareness and helping to address that, that's what Urich says in her article, is that seeking that frequent critical feedback from bosses, peers, employees, whoever it may be, seeking that is an effective way to help overcome that lack of self-awareness and the issues that can come along with not practicing self-awareness. So that feedback is going to be very helpful in that. I think the next thing that I would want to mention, you know, is just kind of those practical steps. You know, when we think of, you know, pulling all of this together and thinking, okay, even though we've talked about different examples of how we can do this, if we take a step back and just kind of look at it kind of big picture, I'm going to use an example from, it was a TEDx talk and it was by Tasha Urich. You know, she talked about just listing out those things. What are those things that I need to work on? If I look at myself and I see there are things that I need to work on, there are things that I can improve, list those out. And like we talked about, let's don't perseverate on that why. Maybe we ask why, but we need to remember and move on from that. You know, a big thing too is we've got to remember we can't just acknowledge, oh, these are things that I struggle with that I could improve upon, and just stop there. We have to actually have an action plan. And so trying to think of which one do I want to work on first, and just picking one, because if we're trying to tackle them all at once, it can be overwhelming and we're probably going to find ourselves just giving up, not having a good, well thought out plan with it. So choosing one, what is one that we feel is going to make a big difference whenever, as we start to improve upon it? Choosing that one and working on it daily. It is a daily practice with self-awareness. And I wanted to kind of tie it into an example of something that I do with clients. You know, Kelly's done very well mentioning like how self-awareness really just ties in well with a lot of things that we already do in our practice, you know, and how it ties into the different terms and principles and things like that. Kind of along that same line, like there are clients that I have who engage in challenging behavior. We've kind of identified, okay, here's these issues or things that we need to work on with our client. And then we choose that one thing, you know, that problem behavior, that challenging behavior. And we do these, what we've called problem-solving exercises. So whether it is real-life situations that have happened or that could potentially happen based on their environmental circumstances. And it's presenting that scenario and practicing the thought process and saying out loud what we should do in those moments. And maybe even talking about, if that happened, this is how I would feel. This is maybe what I would want to do, but this is what I should do and why. And we practice doing those kind of things in order to help in those real life situations for those changes to come about. And it just makes me think of, you know, that daily practice that we do. And so I think of, in that same way that I work on that with my clients, that's something that I could, that, you know, that I could practice as well in this practice of self-awareness of what is it that I need to work on? And then just spending that time each day addressing it and practicing what I should be doing. And then over time, we'll gradually see that those things will change with us. We'll improve in those areas. And hopefully that'll improve our outcomes that we have with our coworkers and with the clients that we serve.
One of the really cool ways that we can take data on this is looking at the constructional logs from Israel Gold Diamond, because with those, you're looking at the environment that you were engaging in this behavior, what your intent was during that time compared to what actually happened, and then your emotional response based on either following through with what your intent was or with, if you didn't, you chose to do something different. And when you start looking at that, like you said, Shanna, it really gives you this better understanding of how you receive things. And then also, being enlightened, if you will, to how other people, we don't all think the same way. And as you start to kind of unpack and see why you think the way that you do, and then going forward, what changes you can make, or what, oh no, this worked out well, let's continue it, then we can continue to make progress. And so I think the constructional log is one way to incorporate this self-monitoring of your own behavior. And then if you want to extend it, you can work on teaching, like Shanna mentioned, she's working with teaching her learners how to be a little bit more self-aware and see how their behaviors are influenced by variables in their environment, and then the consequences of their actions and how that influences the environment even further. So we can take this and not just consider it for ourselves, but teaching our individuals, the learners, teaching the staff members that work with them or the teachers to be self-aware of their response to the learner during certain times or, throughout the day. What I think is really cool, because self-monitoring is, you want to see certain behaviors happen and you need to have a pretty solid SD for those behaviors to happen. And so in a lot of self-monitoring, it's cases where we were teaching self-monitoring on improved data collection. And so timers were used. When the timers went off, then, you could go report your data. And that is a version of self-monitoring, doing checklists for completing procedures. And that's just one cool way that we can kind of build up this self-awareness. We start with basics, and then as we build on it, we can get a little bit deeper and we can start to tackle the harder issues. So thinking about what a lot of people are familiar with, doing discrete child training with a kid, maybe at a table, and, and the session is going well, things are, we're getting good responding. I've got, a good ratio of reinforcement to response. Then things start to go poorly. And by being more self-aware and self-monitoring of the environment, the context, your individual that you're working with, yourself, you can react in a variety of different ways. And that's where I think the really interesting part is of self-awareness, is when it comes to being able to engage in that behavior in novel situations, and not just a novel, easy situation, but novel situations, including crises. Because a lot of times that's where behavior analysts get called in. We might be the last resort in some cases. So by having this in our toolbox, essentially, having this skill in our tool set, we're able to go in and not just make changes while we're there, but we can teach the other individuals that are present and that have a stake in this person, in this learner's life, how to also become self-aware and to think critically when incidences occur. Specifically, some of the recommendations that I came across in the self-monitoring clinical practice, and in several other articles and blogs that I've read about self-awareness and mindfulness and practicing. And I know in my own mindfulness practice, I do work on my breath and remembering to breathe. And that was one of the things they mentioned was one doctor, that's his practice that he does. Before he walks into his treatment room or he goes to see a patient, he stops and he takes a breath. And what he says is that it helps him to reduce any kind of bias that he goes in with. It essentially just resets him. So that's his SD. That's his SD to engage in mindful behavior, which I think is so cool. Like, I'm walking in, I need to engage in a behavior in order to calm myself down, that's also going to become the SD for me to engage in further behaviors. So again, I think it's so cool to see this behavior flow and just how a simple act of taking a breath can change your response to anybody else. Now, another one that they brought up, and this I think goes along really similar to Shanna and Tasha's talking about the internalization and then turning it externally and asking those what now questions. One of the other clinicians from the article mentioned that their thought process is, if it isn't this thing, like if it isn't this diagnosis, then what else could it be? And just having that at the forefront and kind of putting that as a filter as he's receiving other information and reviewing the data and talking with the patient. These are all things that we do as behavior analysts as well. We review data, we build rapport and interview, we run assessments, we have tests. we do similar things. We just use some different terms for it, and we're looking at slightly different things, but the comparison is there. The similarities are there. So for us to remain curious and to be aware of novelty and to be more attuned to when changes happen, things like pressure changes, it doesn't just affect the weather outside, but it can affect someone's internal state. And that's something, you know, with monitoring and taking data, we can maybe capture, you know, the weather shifted. Maybe they're getting a migraine from it, or they have a sinus headache because there's so much pressure on it. But it's asking that question of, if it isn't just escape from demands, what else could it be? And we have our four functions, but not to say that the four functions are inaccurate, because they're 100% accurate. It's just, there's a lot more that goes into it depending on your learner. So it may not be just as clean cut. And especially when you see, oh, if I remove myself, what changes? Or when the staff are with them, or the guardians are with them, or the caregivers, you know, what are the dynamics there? So if it isn't just this function, then what else could it be? What do you think, Shanna?
Couple other things I'm thinking of, you know, we're talking a lot about our self-awareness and us becoming more self-aware as behavior analysts, as those of us who are working with our coworkers and clients and all. And it makes me think, you know, what I mentioned in a previous episode about, you know, working with supervisees. And in that episode, I talked about how we need to remember we're always modeling for our supervisees, you know, and that also includes like this practice of self-awareness. I keep bringing this up because we've got to think of, not only do we want this for us and the benefit it has to our clients, but we want to make sure that this is having that ripple effect out into our field. And so one way to be able to do that is through the supervision that we provide to others who are also going to be in our field doing the work that we're presently doing. And so one is, remember, it's an opportunity to model self-awareness and the practice of self-awareness to the supervisee, and also having discussions with them on, you know, what are the benefits to self-awareness? What is self-awareness? How do you practice it? That kind of thing, so that that individual and those that they work with can also reap those benefits. And we ultimately have better outcomes. And, you know, we're in this field to help people, to enhance their lives. And so we can have a greater impact through supervision. That's one way to have a greater impact, is not only impacting ourselves and those we work directly with, but having that ripple effect into the lives that our supervisees will be working with. And then another thought I had too, beyond just self-awareness for ourselves, you know, is also thinking of stakeholders and how they can benefit from self-awareness. Can't we all? But, you know, and then I mentioned also blaming, like how we can easily get into the blame game. And perhaps we have stakeholders who blame, whether it's a parent, caregiver, dayhab, group home staff member, or whoever. Let's just use an example of a stakeholder blaming and just saying, you know, this client always engages in this behavior and it needs to stop. It's just causing problems and all that kind of stuff. And just looking at it and focusing on how the problem is the client and the problem is with the client. But then helping those stakeholders become more aware of, yes, the client needs to work on this behavior, but who else needs to be doing something with it? You know, it's that environment that we need to consider and the changes we need to make to the environment. And sometimes that environment means, you know, the staff members, the parents, you know, making changes. And so if you look at it from the standpoint of, I don't like the way that this client talks to me. I don't like the tone of voice. I don't like the words they use, the volume of their voice, all these different kinds of things. But we step back, or we have that stakeholder step back and really evaluate the situation and evaluate their behavior, we may realize that behavior is being modeled for our client, you know, and how if we're more self-aware, if our stakeholders are more self-aware, they can help identify the problem and the solution to it. So, you know, Kelly and I have been in discussions about like ways of training those that we work with to be able to better identify what are the problem behaviors and what should I do? What kind of changes should I make in the environment to bring about the changes we want to see? And so self-awareness and the practice of it is a great thing for us to try to help teach those stakeholders and our clients so that they can continue this process of changes, of those changes in their life whether it's increasing certain behaviors and reducing others. But the more that they are self-aware, that's one more step or tool that they have to be able to help bring about behavior change. And here's your second keyword, growth, G-R-O-W-T-H. With hard work comes growth.
I think one thing to note with your comments about blaming and things like that is that the self-awareness, the self-assessment, self-monitoring also starts to clue you in on your values and things that you find important. And then it leads you to start looking at what other people think are important and what they value. Because, you know, again, we don't have the same mind. We don't all think the same way. And we have different histories and different things are reinforcing. And so with that different kind of motivation, when you start working with other people and this awareness of their perception and their interpretations and their, and then extended forward of their values, and those values are shown in the behaviors that they engage in. And so if we're able to be aware of that, then we can work better with people on either, you know, maybe reframing that set of values. Like Shanna, you mentioned, you know, modeling things in front of staff. And so, and I've heard this from parents and I've heard it from teachers and dayhab and group home of, well, you know, I prefer them not to use curse words or use, you know, foul language, but this, you know, maybe the staff think that no one's hearing and, oh, they may be cursing in front of them, or, you know, having a conversation about, well, what do other adults do? And then you kind of, once you start to unpack that, you realize that, well, this person just has very strong beliefs or values that, you know, professional language should be used at all times. Okay, that's understandable. And we can have a conversation about it. And you are allowed to hold on to those beliefs. That's awesome. But in this context, or is there something that we can compromise on? Is there a way that we can make this better for everybody involved without it being really intrusive? And so I think that ability to, you know, understand someone's values and how that motivates their responses to things that go on in their environment is really important. And one of the last things that I came across was just the self-monitoring clinical practice goes a little bit into the neuroscience behind self-monitoring and self-assessment. And they discuss the areas of the brain where emotions are regulated. And it's also a similar area where those fight or flight responses come in. And so being able to essentially calm that down, take that breath and let it kind of process one step further. So you don't just have a knee jerk, you don't have that flight or fight response, you process and you respond to all the variables that are present. And it's just a little bit smoother. And so I thought it was really cool as they were talking about this, because they also mentioned, and I've seen this in other articles with neuroscience, is that as you're practicing that, you're creating these cool new neural pathways, and they just get stronger and stronger the more that you practice it. So it's just like anything, your brain's a muscle and you have to use it and you have to practice these skills, like Shanna said, on a daily basis. So even if it takes a bunch of energy, but the more that you practice, the more you become fluent with it, and it becomes easier in some cases. And when it starts to become too easy, okay, let's change the goals then a little bit. What now, like Shanna said. So at this point, I would like to kind of just wrap things up. So Shanna, this is our takeaway section. So what are your like main takeaway points?
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, takeaways, just remembering, you know, what is self-awareness, you know, remembering to consider that internal and external. You mentioned something, you know, very important is there's going to be some tough moments as you're trying to become more self-aware, uncomfortable, but just knowing what's going to come out on the other end of it, how much better off you will be as a professional and also as an individual. So those kind of things, when you think of, I'll call them your weaknesses, your areas to improve upon, again, try not to tackle all those things all at once. Choose one. One at a time, practice that one thing daily. Practice, practice, practice. You know, like Kelly talked about those neural pathways, just remembering to practice it. And then, you know, whenever it becomes easy, kind of becomes that habit, you've mastered that skill, whatever, however we want to label that, then just, you know, go to that other thing in the list, you know, and just start working on that. remembering to model for others, you know, the stakeholders that we have, supervisees, our staff members and coworkers, and then also just sharing with them, you know, about self-awareness so that we can have, like I said, that ripple effect and a greater impact, a greater reach in helping people more become more self-aware. Because in the end result of all of this is if we're practicing this, then we've set out on what we wanted to do. I mean, most of us came into this field, most if not all, come into this field to make a difference in the world, to improve lives. And this is just one more tool and one more thing to help us to be able to do that.
So this self-monitoring clinical practice, a challenge for medical educators. The challenge I am posing to myself, and I'm now posing to you because I think you have mentioned that you've taken on a new task for self-awareness. So I just wanted you, if you were okay with, to share real quickly what your current practice is.
You know, one thing I think it's kind of, I've realized as I've looked at these things, it's kind of, as I fix one, it's kind of a, you know, there's the next step in the thing. So I think the one thing that I'm going to try to start working on is not overcommitting, which is going to lead into also what I put on my schedule to actually do whenever it's put on there and not just say, oh, I can push that off a little bit. You know, so making sure I don't put too much in one day at a time or over the course of a week, but then also making sure to do what I've put on there to get things done. That way I meet deadlines, you know, so that's where I'm going to start working. And I think I talked about a lot, but I'm kind of in that process. I'm really going to kind of narrow it down to what is that one thing that I can do and that I can practice each day.
I love it. And one of the main reasons I super dig it is because it's not just a feeling or an intangible thing. It's nothing. No, it's observable. It has a permanent product. Either you did the thing or you didn't do the thing. And so self-awareness isn't just this fluffy mental concept where I need to be in touch with my feelings and understand how that's one area of it. But there's these other areas where just being self-aware about what I do on a day-to-day basis. I think that's so cool. Well, I think with that, this is the end. You should have received two keywords at this point. If you would like to purchase CEs, please pop over to our website at www.atypicalba.com. For more conversation, check us out on Facebook. That's the Atypical Behavior Analyst. And until next time, adventurers and knowledge seekers, we'll see you later. Goodbye. Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.